Please turn to Psalms 96. Psalms 96. About 3 weeks before Christmas, some life circumstances led me to this psalm, and I have been sort of mired in it in thought a little bit throughout the last couple months through Christmas and up till now. I got to do a devotional and a deacon's meeting about it, and it just flowed very, very nicely into a sermon when Ryan asked me to preach when he was gone. So, Psalms 96, we're going to read all 13 verses. Oh, sing to the Lord a new song. Sing to the Lord, all the earth. Sing to the Lord, bless his name. Tell of his salvation from day to day. Declare his glory among the nations, his marvelous works among the peoples. For great is the Lord and greatly to be praised, for he is to be feared above all gods. For all the gods of the peoples are worthless idols, but the Lord made the heavens. Splendor and majesty are before him, strength and beauty are in his sanctuary. Ascribe to the Lord, O families of the peoples, ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. Ascribe to the Lord the glory due his name. Bring an offering and come into his courts. Worship the Lord in the splendor of holiness. Tremble before him, all the earth. Say among the nations, the Lord reigns. Yes, the world is established, and it shall never be moved. He will judge the peoples with equity. Let the heavens be glad, and let the earth rejoice. Let the sea roar, and all that fills it. Let the field exult, and everything in it. Then shall all the trees of the forest sing for joy before the Lord, for he comes. For he comes to judge the earth. He will judge the world in righteousness and the people in his faithfulness. One report I recently heard just after Christmas was looking at the escalation in depression. Apparently, the time right after Christmas is a high time or a swelling time for depression among many people. The report said that it was because of an unrealization of expectations. If any of you have kids, you know Christmas Eve can be a time where kids sleep very little. For the McCanns, they're on both sides of it. The little kids don't know what's going on yet. The older kids, they know what the next morning is all about. I've heard that you can try opening one present the night before. Or I don't see how that could, that's just going to make the problem worse. It's like putting your hand in the cookie jar but not getting to take all full handful of cookies. When you get to the Weberg's age, you finally get some kids that are like, oh, it's another day. I got to get up early and deal with all the little kids running around. And when you get to Susie and our age, it's like, wow. You just like to sleep in some morning. But with Christmas 3 weeks in the past, have you taken time to review how you did with Christmas? That question can evoke two responses in us. I guess three. One would be a greedy response of, man, I didn't do so good, or I did great. But a second response could be, you get to look at what other people received from you, and you get to see the excitement in their eyes. We have kids and you have parents, siblings, they get a present, and you can just see in their eyes that is exactly what they wanted. They had no clue they were getting it. They had no clue that even existed, and that was what that just fit the niche. Also, you can look at the presents that we get from people. Time around here is really fun. Get these little goodie bags for people, a little bit of candy, something that tasted really extraordinary. You never knew you could put those two components together, but they taste good. You see people opening them. You as a receiver are seeing a blessing God's providing for you. If you were to put that in Fox News, they would probably tout that as the spirit of Christmas. A phrase often quoted is, it's better to give than to receive. Charity is often touted as the greatest present this time of year. But we as Christians, we have to go one step further than that at Christmas. When we look back 3 weeks ago, I didn't do the math, it's about 3 weeks, there's another response that has to be measured. How well did you do in celebrating the real or the true reason for the season? Throughout Christmas season, pastors reminded us of the humility of Christ. Pastors can pick many themes: humility of Christ, Christ as a present, Christ as a gift, what he's done for us. It helps us focus throughout the swarm of present buying and onslaught of advertising. Keep our eyes focused on Christ as we approach that Christmas Eve service and the Christmas Eve morning throughout the week up through New Year's. It's a time where we around here had a very nice Christmas pageant. We theatrically ad-libbed, filled in the blanks in the Christmas story. It was really fun to watch all the shepherds in bare feet. It's a time you get to loosen up a little bit. You get to enjoy Christmas. You get to see what Christ has done for you. As parents, we caution our kids on gifts. These are not Christmas. These are just something that our culture has thrown into Christmas. The real reason is Jesus. We keep our kids focused on that. Our pastors keep us focused on that. As Christians, we shouldn't have a letdown in expectations. But you know, sometimes a week after Christmas, you get through New Year's, you sort of lose that buzz a little bit. You've been so focused on Christ, on God, on what he's done for us for 2-3 weeks. Come the first week of January, a little bit of snow, the dreary days get a little bit, you're tired of shoveling snow. You sort of feel like you're missing something. It felt so good 3 weeks ago, and now I just feel like, well, I'll get Easter. That's sometime in April-ish, May. I'll get that buzz back again. But that's not the way our Christian life is supposed to be. We're not supposed to have this letdown. I entitled this message, The Three Imperatives of Proper Worship. Sort of borrowed that from a couple commentary people. I guess if you had to form a proposition for this message, it could be proper worship is to happen in our lives daily. Worship, we focus, we do worship really well during some of the holidays. By balancing equally the three imperatives or commands of worship found in Psalms 96. Psalms 96 offers us a beautiful model for daily worship to God by worshiping God properly. If you have any sort of study Bible, you won't find an author for Psalms 96. Psalms 96, I guess I can say, is one of the unauthored. Of course, it's authored by God, penned by a man under inspiration. But we don't know who to attribute the psalm to. There's a little bit of discussion on whether it was borrowed out of what we read earlier in 1 Chronicle, which was where David penned when the ark came back into Jerusalem. Probably the happiest time, I have to believe, in his life. Maybe killing Goliath ranked up there. David, a man who suffered a lot of down but had some really high ups. He authored that 1 Chronicles 16. Some people say that this psalm may be part of a larger psalm chopped down to fit in here. Some say it's been borrowed from other spots. Regardless, it's been given to us by God for us to walk through, to study through in our lives. There's three imperatives as we read down through there. If you have, again, a study Bible, it sort of breaks it into different paragraphs for you. It makes it really pretty easy to figure out what your main points are supposed to be when you're preaching. Psalms 96, verses 1 to 3. Oh, sing to the Lord a new song. Sing to the Lord, all the earth. Sing to the Lord, bless his name. Tell of his salvation from day to day. Declare his glory among the nations, his marvelous works among all the peoples. The first thing we're told to do is to sing. For some of us, singing is a pleasure. I love to sing. Those who have to listen to me, it is not so pleasurable. God has gifted me with many things. Singing is definitely not one of them. I kid with Ryan, I can hit about 3 octaves all at the same time and combine about 6 notes all in the same note. As Christians, we are to be singing, in verse 1, a new song to the Lord. It's a new song, new in the Bible. Actually, it should be translated fresh. It's a fresh song. It's a song both fresh in audience and in content. The audience, this song has a purpose. It's a purpose to tell the nations. Through each of these three sections, this would be given to the Israelites. They are told to take this to the nations. Throughout the Old Testament, the nations are always coming to Israel, coming to the true God of Israel. When they come in to adopt this religion, they have to go through certain practices, circumcision, some other things. This is sort of in reverse. This one's telling the Jews, take this message and take it out. I'd have to believe if you were thinking about this back then, it would be, well, this just doesn't really mesh with everything we think about all the time. We, as Christians today, are new creatures in Christ. If you turn to 2 Corinthians 5, verse 17, it's a very common passage that we're used to. It says, therefore, if anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation. The old has passed away, behold, the new has come. With that transformation in our lives, we're supposed to be having a new song. Though we are separated dispensationally from the ethnic Israel in this command to spread the song to the other nations, we join them in the command that needs to be taken outside of our walls. The singing that we did this morning was beautiful. I prayed it was God-honoring. It was inspirational. Some of those songs just sort of caught you up in it. You were feeling
You had a feeling that what you were singing was honoring to God. We need to take that out of our church, out of these walls. We need to take it out through our lives. This can only be done by purposely doing this in the face of unbelievers around us. If you look at singing in the Bible, of course, you could spend weeks probably studying this, but it appears first, I think, in Genesis 4. But it really, first time it happened, you really come across it, is in Exodus 15. They call it the Song of Moses. It's right after Moses is leaving Egypt. We all know the story. Pharaoh is chasing him. They get up to the Red Sea. They start into the water. The sea's open. They cross on dry land. The Egyptian army comes in. Water's coming. They're all crushed. Israel is saved. Moses and all the people fleeing are saved. And Moses pens this song. It's a time in his life where God has stepped out of the majesty and has come down. And you can't help but see, water doesn't normally pass, open up. Millions of people walk through and it crushed the army behind you. It inspired in him a song, a expression of what was going on in his heart. If you look in the New Testament, I just abstractly grabbed a couple passages. Matthew 26:30, if you were to look at it, it's right after the Passover, institution of the Lord's Supper, the really short little quick four or five verses of it. And it says in verse 30, and they had sung, and when they had sung a hymn, they went out into the Mount of Olives. We know the story. It's our Easter story. There's the prayer in Gethsemane. Peter is cautioned about his denial. It's about to happen. The Gethsemane, and then the betrayal of Jesus. It's sort of started with a song. Acts 16:25 says, and at midnight, Paul and Silas prayed and sang praises unto God, and the prisoners heard them. That's the story of the Philippian jailer conversion. It's, again, it's singing. This one has praying involved, singing praises to God. We look at Romans 15:9. It says, I will sing unto thy name. That's actually being cited as 2 Samuel 22:50, which is David's song of deliverance when he is delivered from the Philistines and Saul. It's a reciting of something that they had in their liturgy. Hebrews 2:12 is saying, I will declare thy name unto thy brethren. In the midst of the church, I will sing praise unto thee. It's actually Psalms 22:2. Here the author of Hebrews is laying out a foundation for warning against the neglecting of Christ. So what do these four passages have in common? You say, Jeff, you've lost your mind. There's nothing in common. You know, that's sort of the point. They're in the Bible, but the singing is done in hardship, some in rejoicing, some in preparing for what the future doesn't know. Sometimes I think I pigeonhole singing into what we just did, and then I'll do it again on Wednesday night, and then we have to do it with the kids a little bit, and I don't allow it to permeate my life, to be part of my worship. We all know worship doesn't happen just between 10:30 and 11:45 on Sunday mornings. It's supposed to happen throughout the course of our lives. Psalms 96, verses 4, 5, and 6. For great is the Lord and greatly to be praised. He is to be feared above all gods, for all the gods of the people are worthless idols. But the Lord made the heavens. Splendor and majesty are before him. Strength and beauty are in his sanctuary. We said there's a new audience. It's the Jewish nation spreading this to the Gentile nations. It also has a new content. This section answers the question, what is the content of this new song? The psalmist looks at the gods of the people surrounding him. We're very familiar with the term Elohim. It's God, the covenant God of Israel. There is also a term for the generic gods, the lowercase g. It's Elohim, H-E-E-M. Here the author uses a, sort of a play on words. He says, your gods, the Elohims, are really just idols, Elilim, E-I-L-I-L-I-M. It sort of says, one commentator says, for all the gods of the people are ungods. That your gods, your small g gods, are nothing gods. It says, for all the gods of the people are worthless idols. All the gods of the people are ungods, they're nothings. But the Lord made the heavens. If you were sitting in your little clay house back in the time of Psalms, you would be very familiar with a couple different gods. One would be Marduk, the patron god of Babylon. We're familiar with Daniel, and that nation, the story goes along with that. Another one may have been Asher, who is the supreme deity of Assyria. We're very familiar with the name Assyria also, especially with all the Daniel prophecies. The Israelites would have had no problems identifying these other small gods. It could have been Baal, the god of harvest from the Philistines. They're very familiar. They'd be able to put their finger on that. Small g gods, they're nothing. Our big G god, he is the god. Well, that's great for them, but how about for us sitting here in Telford in 2015? I mean, we're a Christian nation, right? We don't have small g gods because we're a Christian nation. We're founded on the Bible. We are founded on the big G god, right or wrong? Are there small g gods in our life that are pushing their way in to where the big G god is supposed to be in my life, in your life? Could it be the god of sports? I would wonder if this morning was Super Bowl Sunday, the game is being played right now, would there be a struggle in our lives right now for that place? Would we be, we may be here grudgingly. How about if the stock market was open on a Sunday morning? Would we be more concerned about our E-Trade options or about the Bible? For some of us, what if this morning was opening season a buck? Had to bring it back to us sometime. That would be a struggle to be here. How about if there's a big political debate today? We all have, Satan takes every opportunity to put small g gods in our life that can stamp out the big G god. In 1 Corinthians 8, verse 4, Paul picks up on this idea of the nothingness of idols. He says, "Therefore, as to the eating of food offered to idols, we know that an idol has no real existence and that there is no God but one." We're very familiar with that. It's in his treatise about the eating of meat prepared to idols. So how do we sing this song to others? How do we, once we get out of these walls, we look a little funny. We were walking around the hymnal singing hymns. But there's other ways that we can do that. In my life, it's a little goofy thing sometimes, but I like to, when I borrow somebody else's van or a shop delivery van, I like to leave it on Christian radio. I've always wondered if people thought I was a moron or who's that dope that drove and took the country station off and put on Christian radio. I was meeting one of our delivery drivers on Thursday, and the first thing he said to me was, "You listen to Christian radio?" I was like, "Yeah." Well, here he had picked up my old work van a couple months ago, and he realized that there's another person in our company of 100 people that listens to Christian radio. It gave an opportunity for me to sing what God means to me. It strengthened our friendship. I just pray that sometimes, hopefully, that plants a seed in the unbelieving, or as the psalm says, a heathen nation. Secondly, verses 7 to 9 says, "Ascribe to the Lord, O families of the peoples, ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. Ascribe to the Lord the glory due his name. Bring an offering and come into his courts." Here we have this word ascribe. It's mentioned three times. Singing in the previous section was mentioned three times. Here we find a repeating of this word ascribe. It's not a word that we use. We don't walk around and say, "I ascribe to you this." We think of that as maybe an old English word or something. It's the Hebrew word yahab. It's translated in the King James as to give. Some of the more current translations all use this word ascribe. I really like the emphasis of ascribe. When I think of give, I sort of go back into that Christmas thing. When I give a present to somebody, I am giving out of my abundance. I am giving into your need. I am giving to you, not based on your worthiness. It's something that I want to give you. Sometimes I'm giving it to you so I feel better about myself. It's sort of not the idea behind this word at all. Ascribe, as defined by dictionary.com, is to credit or to assign as to cause or source, to attribute to or impute. It's the idea of giving to somebody that already has. They already own that privilege, but we're giving to them anyway. It doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. It's ascribing is recognition of what the recipient owns and is offering of acknowledgement. I guess in my uncultured mind, it would be if we were over in London or something. That might not even be the right nation for this. But a painting is found. You pick your greatest painter that you would love to find a painting of. It's in some vault behind a wall that was hit by a bomb, and it's just been uncovered after all these 60, 70 years. They pull the painting out, and there's some scribble at the bottom. And you're like, the professional is like, well, that looks very familiar to said artist. And after some study and this and that, they see that it is a Rembrandt. It is a Picasso. All of a sudden, that piece of canvas with it, whatever they put on it, paint, pastels, whatever, is worth a lot of money. Why? Because Jeff Barr didn't paint that. The value is in the person that painted it. And that's just what this means. That's what the idea behind this is. There's a three-part repetition of ascribe to the Lord. The focus, again, is on God. Again, it starts out with ascribe to the families of the peoples. Verses 1 and 3 do the same thing. It points away from the nation of Israel towards the Gentiles. I have to believe that was uncomfortable for them. It's uncomfortable for us. Then your Sunday school was sort of right on point. It was a perfect preparing of my heart for this message again. It was a very good preparing of everybody else that listened to your message. We need to have an outside focus. After dismissing the gods of the Gentiles in verse 5, the Gentiles then would naturally be looking for this emptiness, especially with some of the happenings of this week. Many people find an emptiness. Christmas leaves some people with an emptiness. That emptiness is there. God allows that emptiness to be in lives. He says that emptiness is to be filled by something. Also says glory and strength in verse, ascribe to the Lord glory and strength, verse 7. Strength is the same as in verse 6, which refers to the attributes of God. So many attributes of God, we sort of classify them as big ones and small ones, but they're all of God. It's God is the whole. It's what God is, what he's comprised of. In verse 7, it says, ascribe to him the glory due his name. This is sort of a crescendo. What we think of in some songs, it's holy, holy, and it's a building. That's as much as I'm going to sing for you. It's a building, and by the time you get to that last holy, you've transported yourself into a different state of the song. You're focused. That's what this is doing. It's ascribe to the nations, ascribe to strength, ascribe his glory to his name. The glory and majesty have fixed the focus on the believer and prepare them for verse 9. Verse 9 says, Psalms 96, 9, worship the Lord in the splendor of his holiness. Tremble before him, all the earth. I think it was the second song we sung this morning. It was just worship, worship, worship. And right when you got tired of worship, the music changed and you went into a different worship key. It was a perfect song that God allowed us to sing this morning. Worship the Lord in the splendor of his holiness. The resulted action of this proper focus of ascribing to God, of giving to God what he rightfully owns, will be worship for us. The Hebrew word worship we're very familiar with means to fall prostrate before. It's not this idea of I can fit God into this part of my life and I'll give a little bit here. When we worship God, we just, boom, we fall down. It would be like you think of the old days when you walk in before the king and you see the people crawling down the big stone thing down to him because they know that if he snaps his fingers, they're dead. Or if he says, come talk, they get to come talk. It's that idea. We sort of lose a little bit of that in our democracy. The splendor of his holiness is a combination of all his attributes. Worship the Lord in the splendor of his holiness. There's no way we could possibly wrap our minds around the splendor of his holiness. Ryan has been walking us through Revelations, and you get to near the ends, and it starts talking about the new city. And it's mentioning, you know, all these jewels and gems, and it's painting a word picture, and Ryan does a great job trying to paint that. But even though he paints it as good as he can, we still can't wrap our minds around that. Then you try to wrap your mind around God, and His majesty and his transcendence and his inability to change. And I look at myself and I'm just like nothing. I have none of that in my body. And you look at worship the Lord. How in the world can I do that? Whether one says that God's holiness regulates his attributes or his attributes flow from his holiness, the worshiper or all of the earth is left to tremble when they're standing before him. Worship the Lord in the splendor of holiness. Tremble before him, all the earth. When we find our proper place before God is where we can start to transform our lives, or he can start to transform our lives. When we allow the little g gods of our lives to just slip from our grasp and we grab hold of God, our creator, then we find our proper place before him. But the blessing that we are given is that we don't have a mean God. We have a God that's loving. We don't have that Greek and Roman God who's sitting up on Mount Olympus with a lightning bolt waiting for us to make a mistake. We're not pawns for their pleasure. God created us in his image to glorify him, to worship him. So how well are you, how well am I worshiping God? What picture are we painting of our God to our coworkers? Dan spent a lot of time this morning talking about some burdens in his life. Along with that burden comes a responsibility. It's easy to pick on Dan because he was willing to share. But no, each and every single one of us has that same obligation to the people that we work with, to the people that we come across in our lives, to our families, to our church family. We need to be, when we are properly worshiping God throughout our lives, we will be giving God the glory. Ryan continually tells us and helps us to focus that things don't, Mike Barger was always good at this. You always say, well, that was lucky. No, there is no luck. God gave that to you. God allowed you to do that. We miss our car keys. Instead of frantically searching, we take time. We pray to God, God, help me find my car keys. We find our car keys in that goofy place that they should not have belonged. What do? We just go on, get in the car, and drive away? Or do we stop and give God credit for helping me find something as frivolous as a car key? How about when we're sick? Dan had mentioned this morning also that there's so much sickness. And we're not just talking colds and flus, but break your heart, bone-jarring sicknesses, especially even in our church, even in our little church. Somebody recovers from it. We've been praying for them for so many weeks, so many months sometimes. Sometimes it feels like a year. Sometimes you feel like you've forgotten about it because you just assumed that it was over with 3 months ago. And somebody brings a prayer request back up, and then they're healed or they recover. Do we just move on to the next prayer request, move on to getting home for lunch? Or do we sit and give God credit for that? It's really easy for us to do it around here. It sort of checks off our little spiritual checklist. I feel good about myself. I gave God the glory for this. You know, it's really hard when you get called into the meeting and they say, Jeff, you did a really good job on that job. We made some good money on it. Yeah, I know. It's because I'm such a good service tech. Or just because, yeah, God gave me the ability. God worked that circumstance out. It's really hard to swallow your pride and say that. And it's not so much that you're prideful, it's just you sound like a dope to the unsaved people saying that. But you're giving God the glory, you're ascribing God the glory. Thirdly, third command from God, verses 10 and 13. Say among the nations, the Lord reigns. Yes, the world is established and it shall never be moved. He will judge the people with equity. While singing and ascribing are internal actions only vaguely witnessed by the outside world, saying is pointedly directed towards interaction with the unsaved. We can do the other two from a safe distance. We can keep up our guards. We can sort of feel like we're safe in our little God bubbles and do the others. But when we start saying, you are crossing that hurdle. You've walked off that cliff. There's no safety net anymore. Ever since Luke 2, verses 9 to 11, that's the Christmas story we've just spent a lot of time in. It's my favorite part of the Christmas story. For any of us that are outdoorsmen, spend time outside sleeping under the stars. A few weeks ago, let me read that real quick. Luke 2, 9 to 11, it's right here. And an angel of the Lord appeared to them, and the glory of the Lord shone around them, and they were filled with great fear. And the angel said to them, "Fear not, for behold, I bring you good news of great joy that will be for all people. For unto you is born this day in the city of David a Savior, who is Christ the Lord." A few years ago, it might have been last year, those flash mobs were all the craze. We're going to get together at Montgomeryville Mall at 12 o'clock, and we're going to break out into song. And then they disappeared. They're all over YouTube. They're making the news all over the place. You know, those flash mobs were not much to this. Can you imagine being out in the middle of nowhere, all of a sudden the sky opening, and there's angels singing to you? That had to be something. Ever since that happened, the song that we sing has changed. The song changed from, A, Messiah is coming someday to save our nation. He will rescue us from our captors someday. As of that time, in that song by the angels, the song has changed to, the Messiah has come. And not only that, the Messiah has died. And not even that, the Messiah has risen. We love that song. Up from the grave he arose with a mighty triumph o'er the foes. He arose, he arose, he arose. We love that. We're looking forward to that Easter coming up. The song doesn't end there. The song continues, and he is coming again. Verse 10 points us out of our Christian circle to the lost world. It gives us a song to repeat. The Lord reigns. That phrase appears multiple times. It appears in Revelation 19, verses 6 to 7. Then I heard what seemed to be the voice of a great multitude, like the roar of many waters, like the sound of mighty peals of thunder, crying out, Hallelujah! For the Lord our God, the Almighty, reigns. Let us rejoice and exult and give him glory. In verse 10, it says, Yes, the world is established. It points us towards an unchanging God. An unchanging God with moral standards. We live in a society where what's right today most likely will be wrong tomorrow. What's right for me doesn't have to be right for you. You are your individual. I have no right to step on your preferences as you see fit. There's going to be coming a day when God says, I am the God. These are my morals, and I do have the right to step on your preferences. Also, it says in verse 10, it says, he will judge the people with equity. We have this, I think it's a group of nine people, we call them the Supreme Court. They have the power to judge us, to judge our lives, and whatever they say, we have to live by. They have the equity according to our American Constitution. This word equity means the straight or the upright. Someday Christ will become, and he will be judging with his rule, with his standard, regardless of what we want. The Gentiles, unbelievers, left with emptiness in their non-gods. The believer holds the good news. The good news is the gospel. Psalms 96, verse 11, 12, and 13 says, Let the heavens be glad and let the earth rejoice. Let the sea roar and all that fills it. Let the field exult and everything in it. Then shall all the trees of the forest sing for joy before the Lord. For he comes to judge the earth. He will judge the world in righteousness and the people in their faithfulness. Verses 11 and 12 share the language of Romans 8. For I consider that the sufferings of the present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from the bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. If we return to Revelation 21, we see that there will be a new heaven and new earth. Revelation 21, verses 1 and 3. As you've been reading through Revelations, you get done, you finally emerge from the mire of the tribulation period. And it says, Then I saw a heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself, he will be with them as their God. That is our future. That is our song. That is the end, the refrain of our song. It starts with, there's a Messiah coming. It ends with a Christ returning and us living with him in this new heaven, this new earth. You may ask yourself, what does this have to do with anything? Why can't I just come in here, worship God properly, give him the glory, live my life like him? But why do I got to do this last part? What this saying, it doesn't seem like worship. It seems like evangelism, not worship. Why do they meld together? Why is it important to make a concerted effort to tell others the good news of the gospel? Is it just because Ryan wants us to pick one person this year to witness to? I had mentioned earlier that I was drawn to this passage from a life circumstance. About 3 weeks before Christmas, I was out looking for a Christmas present for one of the boys, and I was hitting one of the local gun shops. There's a man there. His name is Pat. I've become friends with him over the years. He drives a big red pickup truck. If I drive into the lot and I see his truck there, I get excited. Hey, Pat's there. I get to go talk to Pat. He's a very benevolent man. If you are taking a first-time person there to buy something, he always cuts them a real good break. He likes doing what he does. We share a lot of things in common. And it's fun. Every time I used to walk in there, he would always ask me, so how's seminary going? How are your classes doing? Are you surviving? And I would get the opportunity to share with him how things are going. A lot of times I would get to say, usually because I was taking stuff there to sell to pay the next seminary bill, yes, because of you, I get to pay the next bill and continue on. I also get to tell him how God's providing things from time to time, how going to a place, God provided a new exhaust system for my pickup truck. And it's just part of conversation, just having fun with a guy that you enjoy being with. I walked in there that day, about 3 weeks before Christmas, and his truck wasn't there. Not uncommon. He's one of three owners that don't work every single day, every single hour. As I'm looking around, another guy, one of the other owners, got my attention from across the little store. He's like, hey, did you hear Pat died? And we've all been there. You don't know everybody in your life every single day. Sometimes that news of somebody dying catches you. And I had that lump. You've all had it. You don't know what to say next. You're like, okay, did he die from an accident? No. He was in the shower one morning, going to go scuba diving, and fell over dead. If you guys knew Pat, he's a healthy sort of like rest of us, not a triathlete, not a heart patient. 45 years old. You don't die at 45 years old. Maybe if you die young, you die in your 50s, 60s. You don't die at 45. I didn't know what to say. I left the store rather quickly. I had that anger at myself. I was like, man, that's how? Pat knew of my singing to God. He knew that normal gun people do not go and sell their guns for no good reason. He knew I was doing other things. He knew that I valued this to him, just a small g God, to me, a big God, to us, a big God. He knew I valued that thing over some worldly possessions. He knew of singing to God. He knew of ascribing to God. But to the best of my knowledge, today Pat is in hell burning forever because I never took the opportunity to say to Pat who God is. He knew of a God, but he didn't know of who my God was. As I was thinking about it, it's only a 10-minute ride home, I couldn't think of an exact time where I didn't say anything. The middle of a gun shop with a bunch of people is not the best time to witness. As for many of us, where we cross paths with the people that we cross paths with isn't always the best time. In the middle of an office meeting, in the middle of a grocery store, in the middle of a golf course, in the middle of wherever God is putting us in connection with people is not always the best time to witness to them. But what I failed to do was to take the effort to find a time to witness to them. Ryan has asked us this year to pray for somebody. Well, you know, praying doesn't do a whole lot sometimes. Yeah, it checks out that little box on our list of my spiritual concerns for the week, for the month. When Ryan asked me, have you prayed? Yeah, of course I've prayed for them. But he has challenged us this year to take that next step. Is it comfortable sometimes to take that next step and have to sacrifice my time to invite somebody and their family over, to go out to have dinner with somebody that you really don't know what's going to happen? It's fun and it's easy to witness in my controlled environment. And it's not easy for me to step out in faith into the lost environment and trust God that his name will happen. You know, I'm busy. You're busy. We're all busy. It may not be a one-time event. Sometimes you have to meet with people multiple times before the opportunities arise. But we have faith that God will give us the opportunities. Dan prayed this morning that he knows in his life there's opportunities that he misses. He knows that God answers our prayer. And his prayer, and our prayer needs to be that we don't miss those opportunities. So why is this important? Why is this worship important in our lives? Because there's a lot at stake in these commands. It's not just worshiping God. It would be fine if worshiping God was just singing to God and giving him glory for what he is. But there's a third part. There's an evangelism. There's a telling the nations. It's a telling our neighbors. It's we don't want to offend. We know the gospel is offensive. That's the way Christ has the gospel. If you look through the gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Jesus doesn't have a little fan club. He doesn't have 50,000 likes on his whatever social media is. He would have had like 12 likes and maybe a 13th like. And sometimes the first 12 likes probably unliked him from time to time. There's a lot at stake. We have to tell our friends, our family, that their small g gods are nothings. That's hard. It's hard to tell your friends that what they've worked their whole life for means nothing. That their 401k with $3 million in it means nothing. That they're excelling, making the all-star team means nothing. Yeah, it's great for their kids. I'm happy your kids are doing that well in soccer. But it means nothing. Without their gods, they're left with nothing. And they're going to feel that in their lives. We have the good news. We have the gospel. We have that thing to plug into their lives. There will be a day when God comes to return and judge them with equity. For me, Pat's gone. I don't have that opportunity anymore. Another guy at the gun club died a year ago. I don't have that opportunity. But there has to be a time when I quit not having opportunities, when I have redeemed the time, when I have taken advantage of the opportunities and trust God to bless.